Greetings to all of God's people. This is Mordecai Joseph. We're now in lesson 115, 115. And again, we're in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 12. This is where we were last time. In verse 12 we read, "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time." In other words, after the battle with Michael, which obviously he did not win, he was not victorious, and therefore now he's going to pour his last wrath on humanity. And of course, God is the one orchestrating the whole matter. He cannot do anything that God would not allow him to do. And here, what we read in essence is the wrath that God is going to pour, as we read in other places, on his own people and on the rest of mankind. The trouble of Jacob, as Jeremiah would call it, in chapter 30. And Daniel speaks about that time in chapter 12. And then he's speaking also in the context of what Jesus Christ told his people when he was on this earth, that is, in Matthew 24 and, of course, in the other Gospels. Basically speaking about the same time when God is going to finally lay it on mankind, that is, laid very heavily, lay his hand on them, and he's going to begin with his people, and he's going to bring great calamity on his own people to purge and cleanse and purify the rebels from their midst and bring the rest back to himself. And so read it all in the context of the same story, then you begin to understand it, and that God is ultimately in charge of this whole matter. That's why in other places God says, "I'm the one that either bring evil or good to this land, to this earth." You see, he's the one in charge of all things. He's not the kind of a God that some people picture him, that is so weakling that Satan the devil get away with, you know, whatever he wants to do. It doesn't work like that. God is in absolute charge at all times of all things. And that's exactly what is happening here. And this is what Christ is telling him to the Apostle John, 2 years, that is 2,000 years in advance, because he knows what he's going to allow, what he's going to cause, what he's going to bring upon his people and all mankind. And so in verse 13 we read, "Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman," that is Israel, the church. You see, represented now obviously only by some of them, not all of them, but God does not distinguish between the few and the many. They're all Israel. As they are Israel, they are representatives of Israel, but in other cases, they are always Israel, and the few that have been grafted among them also become Israel. And this is always a context, and that's how he begins the story in chapter 12, speaking about Israel with the 12 tribes, and here, only a small part of them that are obedient to God, but when we read here, the woman who gave birth that Satan is going to persecute in verse 13, he's speaking about the entirety, not only about the few of them that came to believe in their Maker and Creator and receive the Holy Spirit and are obedient to Him, but He's speaking about the entirety of the nation of Israel, the trouble of Jacob. So God is going to bring this final calamity upon His people to bring them back to Himself and bring them to their senses. And that's the reason why He came, as we read in verse 13, "The devil persecute the woman who gave birth to the male child," speaking about Israel. And verse 14, "But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, and that she might fly into the wilderness to her place." And so here in specific, it talks about the group of the children of Israel, as many as they are, thousands or maybe more than that, who are obedient to the faith. And so he's switching back and forth the entirety of the nation, and also in particular the wise among them, that God is going to protect. And that's what he kept telling his people all the time, from the beginning of time. That's the manner that he always taught his servants, that those of you who are righteous, that even though the great calamity is coming upon the rest of your people, you're going to be delivered, protected, one way or the other. Not completely bought out of that situation where you don't see anything. No, you're going to go through it to a degree, just like even the children of Israel, when they were in Egypt and God was bringing the plagues upon Egypt. The first three plagues, Israel too, had to be right in the middle of it. And God did not protect them from the first three, but after that he did for the rest of the plagues. And so his own people, they too need it, there is a purpose for it, are going to go through a little bit of it, are going to be some difficulties, so you have to expect those things and not expect that everything is going to be easy. You're not going to go on a carnival ride, you know, on a cruise through the tribulation. It's going to be quite a bit of harsh conditions for all the people of God. Yet, great suffering and anguish and torment and sorrow and pain that is coming upon the race is not going to come upon them. And that's what he's talking about. And so the fleeing into the wilderness includes that. And when you fly into the wilderness, that's not fleeing into paradise. That's fleeing into the wilderness. It's not too beautiful of a place either. But at least you are protected there. So, you know, take it in context, what it really means. And so verse 14 again, but the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent, that is, of the devil. And that's what Daniel is speaking about. And this thing, in essence, happened partly in around 70 AD when the people of God, all the children of Israel, that God told them, when that time comes, that is Jesus Christ, their God, you flee from Judea. And you flee to the mountains. And so they fled to the mountains. And that was for those who were in Judea. Those who were in Rome, those who were in Asia, in Arabia, in other places, they didn't have to do it. So you have to understand it also from that point of view. It's localized, and it's specific, and it's not applicable to every single one of them. And then, after that, he told them also at the end of time, when you see the army surrounding Jerusalem, and of course it happened in 70 AD, so they thought that's the end of time, and he wasn't talking specifically about that, that was only a type, and then there comes the prototype, the final fulfillment at the end of time, and there again he tells them, those who are in Judea, let them flee into the mountains. And then he brings it to their attention that this is going to be in the context of the greatest trouble that ever fell upon the face of the earth and upon Israel. So obviously we know that's the end time. And so we read in verse 15, so the serpent, that is the devil, spewed water out of his mouth. Of course, you know, all that is symbolic, speaking about armies, peoples, enemies, to try to destroy the people of God. And so he spewed the water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood, trying to destroy her. And here it is, you see the false doctrine that was developed by those who came out of the great whore, who are called also harlots in Revelation 17. They developed the doctrine of the rapture, you know, Christ comes where his people is going to whisk them out of the midst of the cauldron and of the trouble. And yet we don't see that here in Revelation. You see the church fleeing to a place of safety and Satan trying to get her. And you cannot equate that with the rapture, which to begin with, nowhere in the Bible do you find anything like that. People invented that. That makes them feel good that way because they want to be totally protected. And the serpent is trying to destroy the people of God. And this is what God is saying. He's going to protect his people. It doesn't mean that every tiny little problem that will come their way, God is going to protect them from that. He's speaking, but generally speaking, the major kind that will prevent them from being obliterated. In verse 16, but the earth helped the woman. You see, they're not in heaven. The earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon has spewed out of his mouth. So God is going to create conditions that are going to destroy all those armies, soldiers, whatever, that are in the pursuit of the people of God. Everything is happening upon the face of the earth. There's no rapture here. Verse 17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring. Because now you have some people who are taken into a place of safety. The rest of them, which by now begin to wake up, not many of them, not all of them, but many begin to wake up and they begin to return to the God of their Father and to their Savior and Maker and begin to obey His commandments. And yet, they're sort of Johnny-come-lately, so they're not with that group. They fled into a place of safety that has been preparing, that was being prepared for her. And we don't know exactly the details of how it's going to happen. What we do know from history, the way it has been in the past, that it's not the general concept that people think. Well, the entirety of the body of Christ is going to be taken away, or the entirety of the people of Israel are going to be whisked away from the trouble to come and all that. Thus I localize things. They happen here, they happen there, like in the ancient times in 70 AD, like in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, and like in the days of Assyria. When the invasions came, part of the children of Israel fled already before they came, like the tribe of Dan, when they heard about the Assyrians coming, they fled, they took on, they got into their ships, because they were mariners, and they took off. And others fled into Egypt, and others fled here and there, wherever they could. And those who remained behind are the ones that were caught. And with Nebuchadnezzar, it was the same thing. When before the armies of Nebuchadnezzar arrived, many of the Jews already fled into Egypt, and fled into Edom and Moab and Arabia and other places, and those who were left behind, they were taken in the net. And then, as it is before that, to protect some that were, from the point of view of God, were better people than the others, or the children of Judah, he took them into what was considered to be a captivity, but actually he was taking them to a place of safety, in essence, into the land of Babylon itself, where Nebuchadnezzar didn't persecute them. He told them, everybody was going to fall out of the city and come to my camp here, I'm going to take you to Babylon, give you lands, give you houses and all that, and you'll be okay. So you see the different ways in which God is doing it, and how he has always done it that way. And so it is in the end time. Some people are taken to a place of safety because they have a need. The others are just all around the earth, left there, and God will protect them wherever they are, at least from the ultimate destruction, but he's going to allow some of the sufferings to come upon them. And so, you read it in the context, and you see the whole story, and you understand it better, the way things are going to be done. And if Christ tells his people, you who are in Judea, flee to the mountains, well, obviously, he's speaking to the people in Judea. He's not speaking about the people in other countries. And so they will need to do that, because the armies of the beast are coming toward that area, toward that territory, and so they need that special protection. But they're not coming to other countries where the people of God are. You see, understand it always from that point of view. And people that don't, they get mixed up. They really don't know what's happening here. And they're not able to understand what they're reading. And so, he's saying again, the dragon, verse 17, was enraged with the woman, the devil. And he went to make war with the rest of her offsprings. And the way he does it, he uses the armies of this world and the false religions of this world. And her offsprings are described as those who keep the commandments. You see, they're obedient to the Torah of God. And many of them are in the Jewish community. And many of them are going to come to know and understand, comprehend more and more of the children of Israel, who now think they are themselves as Gentiles. They too are going to return to the law of their fathers. And as it is, many of them, not perfectly, but many of them begin to understand, to comprehend more and more about the Torah of God and the laws of God and the roots of Jesus Christ and his disciples. And so they go toward the movement called Messianism, where they begin to keep the Sabbath and holidays and other things, that they don't have perfect knowledge. They're still in the dark to a large degree, but at least they're coming closer and closer. And so they too might be in this category, at least, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Again, the testimony that has to do with the very essence of the people of God, who are called the body of witnesses, and they have a testimony of what God is, his plan, his law, his Torah, his commandments, his future, his destiny that he has for all mankind. And his coming, and the real one, not the false one that people worship. And so he's talking again here about the people of God, and mind you, always when he talks about his own people, they are always described as people who keep the Torah, who obey the law of God, not people who say the law is done away with. So you know of whom he's not speaking. And then in chapter 13, we continue the story, where we read, let's go to verse 7, speaking about the false prophet and what God would allow that false prophet to do, and for a purpose. In verse 7, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. So on one hand, you read about a group that is taken to a place of safety, but that's localized. You have to understand it from that point of view. And on the other hand, you read about the false prophet making war with the saints, and he overcomes them also. And so, you see the people of God in different areas, and some are taken to a place of safety, and many others are still there, but they're saints. And God is not taking them into a place of safety, and there is a purpose for them to be there. And so those people, God allows the false prophet and the armies of the beast who speak evil of him, who are going to be in Jerusalem, and there are many of the people of God in the land of Israel, you know, in Judah, they're going to be worshiping God. After all, they're going to have a witness there, the two witnesses, and they're going to begin with, they have a good measure of the knowledge of God, of the law of God, along with the confusion, but, you know, they're going to be greater understanding, greater knowledge, greater comprehension, and more of them will be turning to their Savior and Maker, realizing that He is the true Savior that they always were waiting for. And so, all that is in this context, and so they too are the saints, and of course they are also in other places. And so this is what he's talking about here. It was granted to him to make war with the saints, wherever they are, and to overcome them, and authority was given him over every tribe, every tongue, and every nation. Who gives him the authority? Well, God is the one that gives the authority, and he allows Satan to do what he does, so he's ultimately the one in charge of all that and orchestrating this whole thing. And again, what's the purpose? Well, to drive people back to himself. First, his own people, his own nation, Israel, and then all the other nations of the earth were going to be the children of Israel. So he's, in essence, softening them for the coming salvation, preparing their minds and their hearts so they will turn to God. That's why he allows this beast to take over and to afflict all of them. And so they will be crying to God and seeking his help and would be willing to obey his voice and commandments and Torah and become his people in the future. And so all that is a background preparation for it. And so this is what he say, what we read here. He's been given authority over all, in essence, all the earth, verse 8, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the earth. In other words, an awful lot of people all around the earth are going to fall for the false prophet and his lies and his miracles and his wonders. And of course, that false prophet is going to have the authority of the military, of the state, so to speak, of the people that is going to be riding on top, just like in days of old. And they're going to do the war for the false prophet. And the ones that will come under his boot, he's going to, you know, tell them, you either believe in this religion, which we believe is the true religion, or else. And so the majority would fall for it and bow down and become a part of that religion. It's no longer going to be an effort of persuasion of missionary, but an enforcement. You either, you know, fall with us, you know, fall back into line and obey the same religion that we have, or you're going to be dead. So the majority would rather stay alive. And so God says people like that are not written in the book of life. That's the reason why they give in to a demonic religion. And so verse 9, God is warning all of us, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. In other words, don't fall for it. And he who leads into captivity, verse 10, shall go into captivity. And he who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. So God is going to take care of the false prophet and his army. And here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So they're going to wait until the end when God will deliver them and they will remain faithful, obedient to the Torah, obedient to the law of God, and preserving that testimony of God, the testimony that is understood by those who obey the law, the whole plan of salvation, and who is in the center of it, and how it is going to happen, all those things. And so God will constantly be with them and never forsake them, never leave them. And in essence, as you go through the other books, as you read the entirety of the story, you add all the details, and you read in Daniel about the people of God who are going to go through that, and you read in Matthew where Christ speaking about his own people who are going to go through that, and you read in the prophets like in Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Isaiah, and Moses spoke about it from the beginning of time when he told the people of Israel, when you are in tribulation, the end time, you know, then you're going to realize that you've strayed away from your God and you're going to return to the God of your fathers, and you're going, he said, to obey all these commandments and statutes and judgments which I give you today. They say, these are the people who keep the commandments. They're going to be restored to the people of Israel, to their own people, and join the rest of the people of Israel who were obedient, which are unfortunately only minority, and they're going to go back to their God. And so you have to read the entirety of the story to really comprehend everything. If you just read bits and pieces, you get mixed up, and that's in essence what the world is doing. There's an awful lot of people there studying the prophecies and the Bible and all that, not having the entirety of the whole story. They get mixed up and they invent their own ideas. They really don't understand it, but they will when the time comes. In chapter 14, verse 1, then I looked and behold a lamb standing on Mount Zion, speaking about heavenly Jerusalem, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written on their foreheads. And you have two Mount Zions. There is a spiritual one up in heaven and the Mount Zion on this earth. And the two are going to be linked and become one when the time comes, at the end of 1,000 years. At this point, he's still up there. The Mount Zion, or the heavenly Jerusalem, of which we are the descendants and the citizens, spiritually speaking. And so he says, I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder, and I heard the sound of harpies playing their harps, and they sang, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures, and the elders, and no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. And so, 144,000, they are on this earth, and the Lamb is leading them, not that he is yet on this earth, because he hasn't descended yet, but they are his people. And all those things are symbolic. You have to read it within the context of the whole story of the 12,000 from every tribe of Israel. And then verse 4, these are the ones who were not defiled with women, that means churches, for they are virgins, that means they are obedient to the Torah of God, and they are not mixed up with all the lies and fables and deceptions of the other churches out of which they came. And these are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And again, as I mentioned before, that the 12,000 of each one, whether it is an exact number or just symbolic, that God is going to call an X number out of every tribe of Israel and preserve them, and they are going to be members of that bride. And when you consider that you're talking about a period of 2,000 years, and also at this end time, obviously 2,000 is not the correct number, so that would sound more like symbolic, but whichever it is, we're going to find out exactly in the future. What we do know is that God is calling people, and has been since the day that he came on this earth, and opening their eyes and their hearts. That's beside those that have been called before that, so in the days of Abel, and then among the children of Israel and the prophets. And all these people are going to be the members of the first fruits, and they're going to be a part of the bride of Christ. And they're going to be a part of the spiritual part of the bride of Christ, because the bride of Christ will be the entirety of the house of Israel. It will be both physical and spiritual. But here he's speaking about the first fruits. And that's in essence what the people that followed Christ all this time. They're just the first fruits. They're not the harvest. You see? They're just a part of the bride. They're the first fruits of the bride. They're not the bride. They're just a part of it. No more than the first fruits are the harvest. You see? You have to understand the entirety of the story. And this is what he's speaking about. Just speaking about the first fruits of them, you know, the few that appear first on the tree, just like you find on a fruit tree. And then comes the entirety of the harvest, and they're all a part of the same. The crop, that is, that comes out of the tree. And this is what he's talking about. And in their mouth was found, verse 5, no deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God. And does that mean they are there in heaven? This means that the Father, who is the God of all the earth, who is the one that begets all of us, since they have repented and they have been washed by the blood of Christ, they are not without any fault. In other words, they are not with a fault before Him. In other words, they are guiltless. There are no sins, there are no iniquities. And then when God atones for all the rest of the entirety of the house of Israel, they too will be in that position. That's why He said earlier by the prophets, the time will come when the iniquities of Jerusalem and Judah and Israel will be searched and will not be found, so they too will be without fault before the throne of God. And this is what he's talking about. But again, you have to understand the entirety of the story, and these are just bits and pieces, and if you don't put them all together, you get mixed up. And then, let's go to chapter 15, where we read in verse 2, "And I saw something like a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who had the victory over the beast, over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, standing on the sea of glass, having harps of God." And again, if you don't understand the whole story, you get the impression that this is happening in heaven, and it's not happening in heaven. These are the people that God is calling, and has been calling, and are his people, and therefore, as Christ said, "He that overcomes shall sit on my throne, as I sit on the throne of the Father." And so, you might even say here that this could be depicting a time when the saints of God, which are going to be the people of God, may have an audience with the Father and receive the divinity directly from him. We don't necessarily understand every tiny little detail that we read. We know generalities. We know that Christ is coming to this earth, and the saints are going to rise with him, and they're going to sit on his throne, and he's going to have his own sea of glass, as he always had before when he came on a traveling throne, and that was a sea of glass, and that could be speaking about the same one, the one that he has. So in this case, he could be speaking about that. Anyway, verse 2, "And I saw something like a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who have the victory over the beast, over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, standing on the sea of glass, having harps of God," harps of Elohim. "And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying." And mind you, when God of Israel, the one that Paul later on called Jesus Christ, when he descended on the Mount of Sinai, the elders of Israel that went up there with Moses and Aaron, they had a sacrifice there, and they ate before God, and they saw that he is sitting on a sea of glass. So this could be speaking about the sea of glass, of Jesus Christ himself. And it's not speaking about being up in heaven. Since they are going to be on this earth, wherever the bridegroom will be, they are going to be there with him, and he's going to rule over the house of Jacob, and he's going to be in Zion, he's going to be in Jerusalem, he's going to descend on the Mount of Olives. You know, you put all those things together, and you begin to get the real picture. Unlike people who have no knowledge, no understanding, they read this, they think all those things are in heaven, everybody's going to heaven, and they get totally mixed up and don't understand anything they're reading. And so they invent their own theology and hope for something that will never happen, and aim for a destiny that will never become a reality. Yet, as God always says, the wise shall understand. And so, verse 3, "They sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, Great and marvelous are your works, Lord God Almighty, just and true are your ways, O King of the saints, who shall not fear you, who shall not fear you, O Lord, and glorify your name, for you alone are holy, for all nations shall come and worship before you." They are coming, as we read later on, or before that in the prophets, as we read many times before, they are going to come before him in Zion, where he's going to dwell in the midst of the children of Israel, and this is where all the nations of the earth are going to come and worship before him. And this is the context, and this is what he's talking about. So you can see that everything that we are reading here has to be understood within that context. When Christ comes down on this earth with a sea of glass, and that's his throne, and all the saints are going to be with him on his throne, and that's the throne of the Father also. In other words, it's the seat of authority. And that's what has to be understood. You know, it's a generic term. And this is what they're saying, "And all nations shall come and worship before you, for your judgments have been manifested." That means the judgments over the nations. And verse 5, "After these things I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was open." Again, you read tabernacle of testimony, just like the one that was made on this earth. The tabernacle of the testimony, in other words, it was the ark of the testimony there where the law of God was, which reflects the very nature and mind of God. And so you see the same thing up there in heaven, and based on that, God told Moses, "You copy those things that you see in heaven, the same thing on this earth." So you see the Father being up there and Christ being down here with his nation, with his people, with his wife. And out of the temple came the seven angels, having the seven plagues, clothed in pure bright linen. And so the story goes on, all the plagues that the Father is going to bring upon humanity. So he's going back and forth here in time sequence, and you have to understand the totality of the story to know when he's going back, when he's going forward in time sequence. Otherwise you get mixed up and you don't know where we are. And that, you know, that's the way you should understand the whole, in essence, the entirety of the whole book. Because even in the prophets, God often time would speak about a time in his days, that is in the days of the prophets, 2,500 years ago, and then he jumps forward 2,500 years down the road, and people don't get it, they don't know when. And then sometimes he may jump all the way to the end of the story, or the heaven in Jerusalem. So you have to understand all those things. God gave that knowledge and understanding for the wise to understand, those who obey his voice and commandments, not to those who don't. That's the reason why many people read all these things and they get mixed up, they don't understand it. Now, why is it that they sing the song of Moses? Well, who are the ones that sang the song of Moses? The children of Israel, that's why. When he brought them out of captivity to Pharaoh, which was symbolized by Satan, and that's exactly what you see here, the Satan, the dragon, the serpent, that is going, that is, at least, is attempting to destroy the people of God. So again, when they come out of this calamity, out of this destruction, here again, they sing the song of Moses, just like they did when he delivered them the first time. So you see the link there with the children of Israel, the wife of God, the people of God, the commonwealth of Israel. And again, they're doing the same thing as they did in the days of old, because they're familiar with the song of Moses, they're familiar with the meaning of it. And in the song of Moses, they give the glory and the credit and the honor and the praise to God who delivered them from the power of darkness. And so that's exactly what they're doing here, just like their forefathers had done a long time ago when he brought them out of Egypt. And so you see the link here between the two. And you can read the song of Moses in its entirety in Exodus 15. So they sing the same song, and that's the reason why you find it here. These are the children of Israel, basically speaking. And among the children of Israel, if you remember, those who came out of Egypt, there were also all the nations, strangers that joined with them. So you're going to see the same story again here. The people of God, the Israel of God, and among them, the ones grafted with them. Then we go to chapter 17, and here we read in verses 1 and 2, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came, or the seven bowls, came and talked with me, saying to me, come, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot, or the great whore, in the old King James, in Hebrew, Zonah, that's a name for a whore, and harlot. English, you have whore and harlot, in Hebrew it's the same. The great harlot who sits on many waters. And now he is describing in detail the false church, the one that has been there from the beginning, from the days when God told Abraham, get out of Babylon, get out of this, you know, false church. Because from the Garden of Eden, two religions developed. The religion of those who followed the way of Cain, and they had a mixture of truth and error, you know, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and then the people that remained faithful to God. And so two churches, in essence, two ways of life developed there, and they are throughout the entirety of man's history. And so he's describing that very false church at this end time, in its final reincarnation, and its teachings and doctrines. And so he's calling her the whore, because she was always a whore, a harlot. In other words, when you adulterate that which is pure, this is what happens. Even his own people, Israel, God now and then called harlot, because when they turn away from him and mixed truth and error, you know, the teachings of Babylon and his own teachings, they too earned that title of the harlot, or harlots. So God is not a respecter of persons. But here in specific, he talks about the two different churches. His true church, the true people of Israel, and the ones grafted among them, and the false church, which he calls the harlot. And so he says, come, I'll show you the harlot who sits on many waters. In other words, she is ruling over many nations, with whom the kings of the earth, see, all the rulers of the earth, committed fornication. In other words, they follow her teachings, and they believe in her teachings, and they are part of her. And the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. In other words, all the teachings of these harlots are fables, they are lies, they are deceptions. Yes, they are mixed up with truth. That's how Satan works. He appears as an angel of light. His ministers who are called ministers who appear as ministers of righteousness, and so it gives them a mixture of truth and then a lot of error. And that's why God calls it wine of her fornication. And all the nations of the earth, to one degree or the other, are within this body, this church, this woman, and they are the false church in contrast to the true church, the people of Israel, and the Torah that He gave them, and the testimony that He gave them to give to all mankind, which they finally will, once God puts an end to this false church, which He's going to do. And so this is what He's saying. All the nations of the earth at this point are drunk with her wine of fornication. That's what God tells us. Come out of Babylon. You see, there are many teaching in our midst which came from Babylon. People don't realize that. And therefore, God, not wanting to bring destruction on His people, along with the others, members of the false church, He tells them to come out of it. Otherwise, they will be plagued with her plagues. And one of the major teachings of this false church has given to the world is that she is the true church. You see, and her teachings are the true teachings that came from God. And the destiny that she paved for all mankind, which is a false destiny of going to heaven and going to hell, you know, all nations of the earth believe in that. And all this are lies, and they did not come from God. God says, you come out of it. Come out of these lies and fables and the wine of the wrath of the, you know, the fornication of this great whore. Come to the truth. Come to the Torah. Come to the commandments that I gave you. To the testimony that I gave you. And Christ made it very plain. No man ascends up to heaven, and the apostles made it very plain. David has not ascended up to heaven. He's still dead and buried with us. You see, so you can see the people of God never told this kind of lies. But the great whore did. And people believed in that. And many in our midst do believe in that, and we should come out of it. And verse 4, the woman was arrayed in purple. Well, actually, in verse 3, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And of course, that's a vision that John is carried into the end of time. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, and the church is described as a woman always, sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And if you don't understand the terminology here, you don't know the rest of the story, you just don't get it. Speaking about a woman, about a church that has been going on generation after generation, especially in the past 2,000 years, ruling over certain reincarnations of that body, different eras, different epochs, and sitting on a city that has 7 hills also, and so forth. And so the woman, verse 4, was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious ones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication, which she thinks, and all the rest of the nations on the face of the earth, and all the believers, all those who follow her, they all think that's the truth. This is the theology of God. You see? And yet God calls it for what it is. And that's why He tells people, come out of it. You cannot be in that and then worship me and think that you are my people. And verse 5, and on her forehead a name was written. That's what God calls her. Mystery Babylon the Great. The mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. And that mystery Babylon began from the days of old. It's not a new one. And what you have later on, 2,000 years ago, that came supposedly out of the teachings and the preachings of Jesus Christ was just a reincarnation of that false church. The church out of which God told Abraham, get out of that place. You see, and to this very day, that woman goes on in different reincarnations with different changes that are basically all the same. Lies and fables and deceptions and mixture of truth of the Word of God. And that's what deceives humanity. And she is the false church. She is of Satan, while the other one is of God. With all her problems, she is of God. And God is going to purge and cleanse and purify her. And it is to her that He gave the Torah, His pure truth and testimony. And it is with her that he had a marriage. And she is the bride. And yet here is the one that is pretending to be the bride and calling herself the bride and the wife of God and all those lies and deceptions that she fed everyone. And this is what God calls her. And so verse 6, he says, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. In other words, since she claims to be the true church, anybody who disagreed with her, she would burn and kill. And in the past 2,000 years, that's exactly what she did. And there's going to be another round of martyrdom, and on the people of God who keep the Torah of God, and this church is going to go after them to try to destroy them. And verse 7, but the angel said to me, why did you marvel? Well, let's see, read again verse 6. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. You know, he marveled at the awesomeness, at the greatness of this woman. And remind you, you have to remember, who is John? John is a member of the house of Israel, of the commonwealth of Israel, of the bride of Jesus Christ, of the people of God, of the people of Israel. And he sees in that vision the full church. And so John is fully aware of the history of the church, because that's not something new to him. From the days of Abraham, the false church, Babylon, and all her teaching and all her lies and the idolatry that his own people fell into because of that, I was always a part of that false church. And so he looks at that and he sees the, you know, the great manifestation of this woman in his vision, not only of what she is now, what she was before, and you know the totality of this deception of the devil, and he marvels. And so verse 7, the angel says to him, but the angel said to me, why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carried her, or that carries her, that means the army, the civil government and the military, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. And the beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel. In other words, he's speaking about what is going to happen in the history of this church. It's going to rise, going to fall, it's going to rise again. You know, this is not the time to describe all these details. That's not the purpose of the series. But in essence, he's speaking about the false church and the upheavals that she went through, going up and down throughout ages. And yet, nevertheless, he's speaking about a final resurrection, which is going to be on top again, and that's when the great calamity is going to come upon the people of God. Because now that she will have power again, she's going to try to enforce her way and to win the children of Israel to her side. In essence, this is what the devil is doing, actually, trying to destroy the people of God, the people of Israel, to lead them astray, to lead them into deception, as he did many, many times before. And with a good measure of success, because many fell for it. And to this very day, many are falling for it. And that's why God says, come out of it. Be mindful of it. Be careful. And many of us, in our midst, that we're fully aware of, went back to that very state of mind, you know, to this very deception, to this Babylon, and they think that they walk in the truth. And that's exactly what happens to all these people who are members of this false church. They all think they walk in the truth. I don't think they are, you know, walking in lies. And yet the wise shall understand. Those who know the entirety of the whole story, those that know God and His law and His commandments and His testimony, they don't fall for it. And so this is what he's saying. The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition, and those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. When they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. In other words, they see her again in her full glory, and they're going to be very amazed at that, but they're going to be a part of it, and they would love it. And yet, the people of God will not be a part of it, and this great whore, as God calls her, is going to try to get them again to be on her side, either by hooks or crooks, so to speak. In other words, either they submit to her and become a part of her, or else she's going to kill them. So God is going to allow a measure of that to happen. But he's constantly in charge, and even the grave cannot take away his children away from him, because he can resurrect them. And so Simon is going to allow that. Anyway, let's go to chapter 18, where we read verse 1, and after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. And that's exactly what Babylon used to be all along, because of the false teachings, because it allowed, you know, the mind of Satan into her and the mind of demons, and all those teachings that they had from there, and they worshipped actually demons. And the children of Israel, whenever they strayed away from God, they did exactly the same. They too worshipped demons, even in the wilderness, while they were being brought out of Egypt into the land of Canaan. That's what God told them. You were worshipping demons. You were offering sacrifices to demons. In other words, they were joining Babylon. But now God is going to put total end to this false religion that has begun a long time ago. And in its particular configuration, now it began from the days of Noah, after the days of Noah, in Babylon. And of course it was there after the Garden of Eden also, but then it was destroyed by the flood and started all over again. But at this point God says that's the end of it, because it's going to bring an utter destruction once and for all on this system, on these lies, on these deceptions, out of which God commands his people to come out, or else are going to be a part of her plagues. And so all the demons and all the evil spirits are going to be in that Babylon. And that's going to be their prison, that territory, that land. In verse 3, he says, "For all the nations, all of them, not just some of them, all of them, to one degree or the other, had drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." In other words, they swallowed all her lies. And that's where you find all those religions on the face of the earth. And none of them is the religion of God. Yes, every single one of them has a measure of truth. That's how people are being deceived, and so they see good everywhere, and think every religion is just as good as the other, because all of them have truth. Of course all of them have truth. That's the way Satan works. That's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's good and evil. Yet the religion of God is only good. It's a tree of life, not good and evil. And that's how people are being deceived. You show them some good things, and then they swallow the whole thing. And so he says, "All the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her," speaking about, you know, spiritually speaking, but teachings and lies and deceptions that they swallowed, "and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury," because Babylon was always not only a spiritual power, but also an economic power, a military power. So it was advantageous, you know, for people to be a part of it. Anyway, we're reaching now the end of the tape, so I'm going to stop at this point. Again, this is Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people, and I believe in the next tape we're going to finish this series. Until next time.
The preceding message was taken from the World Wide website at address www.biblestudy.org. This site is sponsored by Barnabas Ministries. Bible Study. You have questions? The Bible has answers.